Well, a serendipitous idea occurred as I was scanning through the current crop of YouTube videos that shows up somehow on my feed. And I noticed that there were a lot of videos on Kali Yuga and on cyclical time, many more than before. And maybe that's just because I happened to look for one recently. But nonetheless, I took it as somewhat of a synchronicity that the collective consciousness is now becoming more aware of the possibility that we are indeed at the end of Kali Yuga, that we are indeed at the end of this cycle of time, and that is not simply a myth or a fiction, but that we are living through the final days of this kalpa. And so as I began to see the number of videos that were covering that subject, I chose three somewhat at random to present tonight. One of them is only 24 seconds, so I think you'll be able to handle that and sit through it okay. The time is getting shorter. So. And it's just basically a tete-a-tete between Joe Rogan and Alex Jones, who are quite currently fashionable in talking about the calamitous situation of the world, and both of them are saying, you know what, it's true, it's Kali Yuga. And they also use the word Ragnarok, which is a word for the twilight of the gods. However, that's not accurate. The twilight of the gods actually occurred at the destruction between the Silver Age and the Copper Age, when the fall of the Lunar Dynasty took place, and the Copper Age then was created out of the separation of Pangaea into the seven continents that we have now, and the destruction of all but a few remnants, monoliths and ruins from earlier times. So that's not the accurate point, because the gods are long gone, but this is actually the moment of their return. So there is not quite an accurate understanding of the difference between the destruction that happens at 6 o'clock and the one that's happening now at midnight. But so then I found another video, a little bit longer, unfortunately, 15 minutes or so, that gives, I think, a pretty good perspective, for the most part, on the fact that in the so-called ancient world, although what we're talking about is Kali Yuga, but early Kali Yuga, pre-Christian period, everyone in the world knew that time was cyclical, and they had basically the same names for the four yugas, which were symbolized in the swastika, by the way. And this was a very auspicious sign, because if you were a soul who lived through all four yugas, it meant that you were there in the golden age. You were a god, once god, who will be a future god as time returns to its origin. So the cyclical time paradigm was universal. You found it in China, you found it in India, of course, but it was there in Greece and Rome, and it was there with the Danu, and it was there with many other peoples. I think all, in fact. So the time cycle is a part of the heritage of humanity that only was jettisoned by the Roman Empire and the Catholic, let's say, bastardization of Christianity, the changing of the real teachings of Rav Yeshua that took time as being linear. There was still an end time, so it was a limited time. And in the same way in the Jewish tradition, a linear time, but a time which was known as a Heilsgeschichte in the German version of that understanding as expressed by Martin Buber and other Hasidim, that although time entropically leads to a decline, not a progress, but at the end there is the time of the Messiah and there will be a world to come. So implicitly, the linearity is still cyclical. And you find that in the mystical Christian mystics as well, the more esoteric teachers who are teaching theosis, the divinization of man, is the return to that. And you find it in the Quran as well, because of Adam being considered the first and highest prophet who had all the names, as we heard recently. So that knowledge returns, and therefore the paradise, which is the environment of the Adamic being, becomes remanifest. And they did have the understanding that the first yuga, which is called variously the Golden Age or Satyuga, Krita Yuga, Satya Yuga, various different names, but it is also referred to as the Solar Dynasty, as the second age is the Lunar Dynasty. But it wasn't that these people worshipped the sun. No, that was a much later fallen state of the remembrance of that. It meant that they were in a state of total consciousness, that the consciousness of every inhabitant of the Golden Age was literally the light of the Sun of Suns, the source of the light that creates the universe and that manifests as the sun and the stars and all of the heavenly bodies and the celestial light that is a reflection of the supreme supernal light. So the understanding of the solar dynasty is the complete consciousness that is independent. It does not require a reflection from another, as the moon requires the light of the sun. So once you get into the lunar dynasty, you already have a shift from non-duality to duality. The duality is still a high one because the moon is full or mostly full, but it is still a fallen state. It is a state where now, rather than being in Atman consciousness, they are in soul consciousness. And then in the Copper Age, the soul and the ego are together. That's one reason why it's called Dwapar Yuga, the two towers, the two powers of soul and ego are in relationship, that the ego eventually becomes dominant and represses the soul, and that begins Kali Yuga. So we have a cycle of time, but it is clear that in the Sat Yuga, time stops. There is no sense of time because every being lives in the present and lives egolessly, and lives in a state in which the world and the self are not different, and the world is perceived directly as light, as the emanation of consciousness and not different from consciousness. So there is a non-duality and a sense that all that is not even a dream, but a perfect reflection in space of the information, the beauty, the power of the self, and that it is the self, that the world is internal to the self, not other than the self. So the consciousness then gradually shifts, and by the time we get to Kali Yuga, of course, the ego is embedded in duality. It has a split mind. It considers the world to be separate and objective and different from consciousness and outside of consciousness, even though it's very clear that nothing is outside consciousness. You couldn't know anything that was outside your consciousness. But there's a belief, and it's a religious belief that's called science, but it's a religion, that we are actually in a world that exists independently of us. Because consciousness is identified with bodies, and bodies are temporary phenomena that come and go in the world. They are part of the impermanence of the flux of time. But the consciousness remains present, even though it becomes unaware of its presence because it becomes lost in thought. And as soon as your consciousness becomes lost in thought and you believe that that thought is what you are, I think, therefore I am, as soon as you become lost in that, you live in the past and the present, because thought is all about that. Wishing that the past was still here or that it didn't happen, but having some relationship, nostalgic or horrified by the past, and some fantasy about the future that is either positive, hopeful, or negative and fearful. But the ego is always ping-ponging between these and is never present. And so it feels a lack of being, because being, the real, is only presence. And the ego never knows presence, because in the present it dissolves, it dissipates. And so the mind continually chatters because it is terrified of its own dissolution, its disappearance into a presence that is so awesome and so full of energies that the ego cannot tolerate it. It cannot tolerate the bliss that would show up if you remained present for an extended period. The ego would begin to dissolve, and all that would remain is presence. This is the whole point of meditation, but very few people meditate in such a way that the presence remains consistent and unbroken long enough to dissolve the sanskaras, the latent tendencies of the ego mind, so that the ego pops back after the meditative formality and is never dislodged from its fictional condition as a character. But the presence that is beyond the fictional entity that one comes to believe one is, because the belief that the mind has reality and represents one takes over as the implicit religion of the ego itself, that cannot be undone or seen through by the ego, because it is based upon that, and it dreads its knowing its own lack of reality, of essence. So it is only in moments of trauma, when one becomes speechless, that one knows presence, or moments of divine love, or being hit by a lightning bolt of Shakti, or one is filled with that supreme presence to the point where the ego dissolves completely, that one has the sense of what the real truly is. So time itself changes its qualities as it goes on and consciousness becomes more dense, and the world, rather than being a dream, becomes something that is all too solid and all too resistant and all too filled with danger, so that it has to be experienced by beings who remain vigilant and on guard and using their minds to calculate their way of dealing with reality and trying to get whatever benefits can be extracted from the flow of temporal change. And the consciousness does not have the luxury of abiding in presence because of its paranoid tendency to need to compare the current situation with the past and try to create an optimal future. So time, from the perspective of the classical period, is seen as a circle that is entirely present all at once. There is a recognition that when you enter a state of total presence, you enter a higher dimension in which the apparent flow of time is entirely here. There is no past and no future. Even though there is history and there is the apparent shift, but actually it's an illusion because consciousness is present throughout it all, and that presence is always here and now. And so all of time is present in every moment, in the same way that the entire ocean is contained in every drop. You are a microcosm of the macrocosm, but all of your past and future lives and all of your experiences are present in every moment if you are silent and still enough to perceive all of that information. It's there, but it's too subtle for the ego mind, which is chattering, to pay attention to. And this is why information can be drawn from the so-called Akashic records. It's simply the information of the entire kalpa that is entirely present in every moment if you pay attention. And you know how to decode that vibrational frequency in which it is contained. So presence is the key to liberation, because presence is non-duality. And so this is why meditation is the path, the key to attaining the liberation that is always here, because in fact there is no one needing to be liberated, since the ego is a fictional entity. And so because you are not the ego, you only believe you are actually that total presence. As soon as that belief is dropped, the goal of liberation is recognized as being your natural state. And it could not be anything else. So this is the understanding that we must be able to fully grok in order to be liberated from not simply the illusion of impermanence, but the fear and desire that the ego is based on as its effort to overcome its lack of being, and which it can never do. So presence is the only medicine to overcome that endless journey through the illusion of time that can never reach fulfillment until time itself comes to an end. So the reason then for showing these videos is that this awareness is coming to be revealed now. the end of time is the apocalypse, which means revelation. And the whole of the truth of the cosmic consciousness is coming into the consciousness of each individual. Not all at the same moment, but it's all permeating into the collective consciousness. And more it will be there, and one's paradigm will subtly shift, one's values will shift, one's understanding of the meaning of life will change without needing to be convinced of it. It will simply emerge from within, and conditions will encourage that shift as it becomes ever more obvious that indeed civilization is in a state of collapse, and the planet in a state of the destruction of the web of life, of nature itself, etc. So that the mind, the conscious mind that wants to resist and deny, will have no basis to be able to refute the obvious moment of the terminal death of the entire life cycle and its transcendence back to the source, that sun of consciousness from which it has all emerged, which we refer to now as the singularity, from which a new cycle will again emanate or seem to. So one of the points that the second video brings up is that in the end, where the ideology of progress hypnotizes people into thinking that things are getting better and better and soon life will become cosmic and space travel will take place and we'll live on all kinds of planets and all of that, and we're entering a wonderful utopia, at the same time that we see that we're actually entering a dystopia and being mass murdered and killed off, and there is no possibility for life at all. Both of these are present in our mind, creating a conflict of which is what is our fate. And you see more and more debates on utopia versus dystopia, but the reality that is becoming more overwhelming is soon no longer going to be able to be denied. But the utopia is correct, because there is a golden age coming. There is a new world, and it is cosmic in scope, with extraterrestrial visitors, etc., etc. So all of these things are real, but they're not real in the way that they are now being presented. And it's the overcoming of the grotesque distortion of the truth that only presence will provide. And so in this second video, it is talked about that in the end, the spiritual teachers who in the earlier times taught freely about the cycle, in the end charge money for the teachings, etc. That's not the actual difference. The difference is that in the classical age, there was the spirit of dana, there was the spirit of giving. Of dana now returns into donation, but there was a free heart that recognized the value of attaining presence, and people would not just give money, but would give their whole lives to becoming disciples who were able to then attain resonance with that vibrational frequency of God consciousness that was being emanated, that would enable the state of presence to remain stable until the ego sanskaras were completely annihilated. So the problem now is in a capitalist culture that money has replaced what in a pre-capitalist world, which had no interest or use for money, it was more time, energy, food, prasad, and the creation of communities, ashrams, monasteries, and places of refuge that were the important projects that were necessary. That is now once again becoming the reality. And the problem with the postmodern gurus is that they don't give you your money's worth. They don't take you to presence, but many of them validate the ego, which is what the ego wants. And they validate its jouissances and its sanskaras and its tendencies. And that's why these illusory religious establishments become very popular and very wealthy and very large, because they serve the ego rather than annihilate it and transcend it. They are not teaching the same truth or the same process. So our knowledge has to understand what the goal is with great clarity, and there has to be a ripening of the maturation of consciousness beyond the ego to the soul level that has the power to override the ego's desires for living in the phenomenal plane in the flux of time rather than in eternal presence. To the ego, that's boring. To the soul, it's bliss. So the distinction between these two levels of consciousness is essential. And without knowing the soul, one cannot know the Atman and return to that state that is the source of the bliss itself and the source of all intelligence. So it's this inaccurate understanding that has to be broken through, which can only happen internally. You can't really be taught this, even though I'm saying it now. The words will have no significance. They will not get in to a deep enough place within the listening mind until there is an internal shift in which the urgency of understanding your real self and becoming truly present to the inner light becomes a fact of your being, so that it becomes a way of life from within, not something imposed or suggested from without. And so it's this shift that, if it doesn't happen, then you can read all the books and hear all the teachings of truth for years, and they will have no impact other than to perhaps give you a capacity for master's discourse. So it has to be realized as the upper drive, the upper death drive that one must totally cling to until one breaks through all the intermediary resistances of the Kundalini ladder until one reaches the ultimate level of Chakra 7 and the infinite intelligence and eternal presence become here and now. So I think that's all I have to say, and we'll now let Joe Rogan tell you the rest of the story, and a few other people who are in these three videos. The third one surprised me when I saw it, and I don't know about the teacher in that one, but I'll let you make up your own mind about it. I'm going to slip away and let Kalki give the discussion facilitation, because Kalki is the main figure in this teaching, because he's the avatar who comes at the end to reveal all of this. So I'll let him do his work tonight. Namaste.